Hello, welcome to the Funds Fanatic Weekly podcast, in which myself, Gavin Lumsden, and usually Dan Grote, my colleague, talk about funds and investment trust. But Dan's on holiday this week, so I'm delighted to say I'm joined by another of our guests, Marcus Fair Mudge, who's the fund manager of TR Property Investment Trust and a series of other open-ended funds at BMO Global Asset Management. But TR Property is what we're going to focus on today. The investment trust had its full year results. And Marcus, they showed that the trust was having a great time. Like many investment funds, the trust was having a great time until February. And then because of COVID-19 and coronavirus, things really fell off a cliff and the net asset value ended up being down about 11.5% over the year. So we're going to talk a bit about that, but I'd just like to start with your outlook comments in the results regarding COVID-19, because clearly that's what we're in the midst of at the moment. So you refer to us being in the second phase of the COVID-19 dilemma. What do you mean by that?
Well, Gavin, thank you very much for having me on, and delighted to talk about the trust and the pan-European real estate market, commercial property market, and residential indeed. The second phase was very much our reference to the fact that for us the first phase was the equity market's very dramatic response, basically from the middle of February to the middle of March, and then after that we saw quite a sustained recovery from the low point of the 18th of March. And now we've moved into what we consider to be phase two, which is this sort of corrugated response, i.e. the market moving up and down in a quite a wide band, lots of volatility as market participants and investors work out who are the winners and losers in our particular world, and how valuation and cash flow is going to look going forward for our very broad range of commercial and residential real estate companies. Lots of companies doing different things, and I'm sure we'll get into a bit more detail about that. But really, from our point of view, the second phase is encompasses the company society reopening as we need to get our economies back and functioning to make sure that alongside the tragic health consequences, we don't end up with similar economic ill health, or try to minimize that. And of course, different countries, and we're invested across the whole of Europe, different countries are doing it in different ways with different levels of success. So we can talk about that as well.
Yes. So Marcus, this week you talk about the fact that the restrictions around lockdown are being eased here and elsewhere, and stock markets have been, until today, have been rallying quite strongly on the back of that. But I'm just wondering, you join us, you're joining us from Dorset, I think, and I'm sitting here in my house in North London. I just wondered if you could just talk to us about as you're assessing the implications of the crisis. We're working from a home, everybody's working from home if they can. What is the impact going to be on the office sector if lots of people decide actually flexible working from home is a thing they want to do more of?
Yeah, the short-term impact is that we think that quite a lot of small and medium-sized businesses will quite quickly, where they can, particularly where they have short occupational leases, they're in serviced offices, etc., they will indeed shrink their occupation and can consolidate to an extent. So we see a serious impact in the very short run in some of those types of landlords. I think looking broader over more longer term into sort of the next sort of few years, we actually think you've got two diametrically opposed situations here. One is that we will see an increase in the working from home. Therefore, it begs the question, do we need all this office space? However, we will also, before a vaccine is developed, we'll be in a situation where we will be maintaining much greater social distancing and basically much lower density of desks in office buildings. So expensive markets like London offices, but also I would include Paris, New York, etc., Hong Kong. You know, we've been driving, companies have been driving down their costs of occupation by basically squishing more of us into a smaller amount of space. But they've been able to do that because primarily over the last 20 years, we've seen very big improvements in air handling and air conditioning. So it hasn't felt like you've been particularly squished. It's been fine. And actually, we got down to about 8 square meters per person. So that's sort of 80 square feet, which is quite small. Now, that is obviously going to reverse significantly. So I think what we're going to see is actually the cost of real estate is going to go up for these companies, because although we're going to be working from home more, we're also going to need to go to the office. We're going to need to have that interaction and dialogue, and we'll want to have that interaction and dialogue with our colleagues. And maybe it just won't be 5 days a week, but you will find yourself getting used to being in a much less densely populated office building, because we won't all be there together at the same time. So we see that we're not believers in the end of the office.
Not the end of the office. So will there be an opportunity in revamping and refurbing offices? Will there have to be lots of work to make them work within social distancing rules?
Yeah, absolutely. Already there are companies that are, you know, those businesses that are making the Perspex screens, etc., are busier than ever. I think for refurbishment of older premises, yeah, it is going to be more costly. And there are, you know, rents will need to compensate. Otherwise, developers won't actually do the, you know, go on risk doing the work. And this moves into a very important point. Of course, at the end of the day, property is like everything else. It's just a function of supply and demand. And if you choke off the supply, as in no developers are prepared to build buildings or refurbish buildings unless they've got the tenants in place, then we will see quite a dramatic supply response, i.e. the supply will restrict. And actually, prior to COVID, that was very much a situation we found in lots of cities across Europe, whereby there just wasn't a huge amount of supply and rents were rising. And there wasn't the supply because actually over the last decade, since the GFC, you know, banks and other lenders have been very reluctant to lend money speculatively. And it's one of the great underpins for performance of commercial and to an extent residential property was this lack of supply. So we think actually that we'll have, you know, that feature of the market will remain with us.
So even though in cities like London, we seem to see cranes all over the place, but in fact, there hasn't been enough construction. You remarked that the London office market was surprisingly resilient last year. And I think, are you in the results predicting a vacancy of around 6% in the office market this year?
Yes, we think vacancy in the West End is currently at record lows. It's down in the mid, you know, threes to fours, and we think that will increase to 6 to 7. But bear in mind that equilibrium, so rents don't really start falling dramatically until you really get above that 7 or 8% vacancy. And for us, we're really differentiating between high quality offices and secondary or tertiary. The point about, you know, for corporates for many years now, or certainly in the last decade, worked really hard to improve the working environment, particularly for sectors of the business, particularly the tech side of demand, where, you know, companies have been fighting to retain staff, attract the best quality staff, and the working environment's been really, really important to that. So cycle spaces, showers, breakout areas, all of this has got, you know, as well as the air handling, natural light, etc. And we think the best space will retain its value.
Okay, thanks for that. Let's move on to another big aspect of our current reality. Obviously, it's a lot more of us are doing a lot more online shopping. So, and that's increasing the pressure on retailers, but creating a lot of demand for supermarkets. So how's that influencing the way you're investing in the sector?
Yeah, so we've been very bearish about non-food retail for a long time. In fact, the trust's only exposure to UK direct UK retail has been through Supermarket Income REIT, which we actually own about 10% in the trust. We own about 10% of that company. And that has obviously been very successful. I'm afraid the structural shift to online and the advancements in home delivery and next day delivery have really been meant that ordinary retail and particularly shopping centres have been a very poor place for a long time. And we believe that COVID is just actually going to accelerate that. Now, the big difference has been between the UK and Europe. In the UK, for historic reasons, we have much higher property taxes rates, which have impacted shopping centres very, very badly. And rents have just been significantly higher for a long period of time. Much of the continent, rents have been lower. What we call the occupancy cost ratio has been lower. And also, online shopping has just not really been a factor. I mean, to give you two statistics, in the UK, ex food and fuel, we're up to about 22% of all retail is now online. The same figure for Italy is 2%. Really, the Italians have yet to discover the joys of online. And in fact, for huge swathes of that particular country, the crisis, the pandemic has really introduced them to home delivery. And we think this is something that will continue to evolve for them and for much of Europe. So we see the online challenge just accelerating. And that, of course, is a bonus for logistics developers and logistics companies, the other side of the retail coin. And we've had, we still continue to have and have had for several years, lots of exposure to logistics players, both in the UK and across Europe, but particularly developers as opposed to the Tritax big box sort of investors of in that field.
Right, so you prefer to buy the companies actually building the last mile distribution depots rather than those who actually own them and are collecting the rent?
A bit of both, really. But we definitely like those that are, because the developer, particularly in a rising market like logistics, they buy the land well. You get a value gain on the land they bought when they've got planning and they put in the infrastructure. Then, because the market is hot in many of these countries, they're successfully building buildings and renting them for better than expected rents. And then the yields have compressed because there's lots of investors out there who want to own the finished product. So by buying the developer, you're actually exposing yourself to a developer investor rather than just a pure investor. You're getting two bites at the cherry. And that's what Tritax has obviously done last year by buying DB Symmetry. But across Europe, we have half a dozen names that are all listed in the annual report, which was published today for the year to March 2020. And investors are welcome to look at businesses like Argon, Warehouses de Pau, Montea, all great, great businesses working in this logistics field.
Okay, that's interesting. Let's just go back to the supermarket. Supermarket income, you mentioned, that's a big holding for you, obviously. They did an interesting deal this week, a joint venture, whose details are now escaping me, but presumably you know what I'm talking about. What a supermarket income announced this week?
Absolutely. It's a very interesting deal. So first of all, about a month ago, they raised 140 million for further investment. And they've just invested 50 million in this joint venture with the British Airways Pension Fund and along with Aviva and Sainsbury's. Now, it's quite complicated and unusual because this is a portfolio of Sainsbury's supermarkets that actually only have 3 years left on their lease. But they actually account for about 7% of all Sainsbury's sales go through this portfolio of standalone supermarkets. So Supermarket Income REIT are confident that Sainsbury's will want to renew these leases that expire in 3 years. And it's a clever deal because we believe that, and Sainsbury's are obviously part of the ownership of these supermarkets. So we're confident that at least with some, if not all, they will renew those leases on terms that are advantageous to both parties. So it's a clever transaction.
Oh yeah, that sounds it. And also, the fund manager of Supermarket Income has got Justin King, the former Sainsbury's boss, on board as an advisor, non-executive. Isn't that right? So presumably they've got a very good idea what's going on at Sainsbury's.
They absolutely have. It's a real coup for Steve and Ben to get Justin on board. What's interesting about Steve and Ben is that neither of them are property folk by sort of upbringing. They both were involved for many years in the CERN leasebacks. And what happened when Sainsbury's and Tesco's obviously finished this what was known as the space race of the 19 sort of from the mid 90s to the mid 10s. You saw both these companies expanding their footprint hugely. Now, in order to do that, they'd buy the land, build the supermarket, and then they'd do what was called a sale lease back. They'd put a lease over that building and then sell it to an investor, get the load more money in, and then repeat the process, you know, rinse and repeat. And Steve and Ben were heavily involved in these sale lease backs. So they have this very deep knowledge of the performance of these supermarkets, you know, which ones are got the best sales rates, which ones are working well, and very importantly, which ones are the successful part of the integration of the online network for these big supermarkets. You know, for some years, people thought, oh no, it's all going to go online and the supermarkets will suffer. But in the US, we saw Amazon, you know, give up on Amazon Fresh and go and buy a business called Whole Foods. So very much seeing that really, the thing about online delivery for food is you really have to use your existing supermarket network to do it. It's not like a hard goods, you know, televisions or bicycles or whatever, which can sit in a big warehouse in the middle of nowhere for months on end. Of course, food can't. It has to be, you know, it's all perishable. And therefore, the fact is the existing supermarket network, not all supermarkets, but what we call class the winners, will be those that are part of the online distribution for these big retailers. So when okay. you go to your big supermarket, you want to check out, you know, are there lots of little vans parked around the side, because that means it's part of a Sainsbury's or Tesco or Morrison's or Waitrose. It'll be part of their online, and we think those sort of supermarkets are here to stay.
Okay, well, while you're talking about this, I actually got another question, not about supermarkets, but about, you're talking about high street retail and shopping centres, clearly, you know, big issues there that you've mentioned earlier. But I wanted to ask you about retail parks, because they've also been under a cloud. And but the argument for those funds and those people investing in them is that, like, as you were saying with the supermarkets now, they can play a role in you know, both physical shopping and in sort of collection points, click and collect for internet shopping as well. And yet the prices of those funds investing in them have fallen a lot. There seems to be a lot of caution about that subsector. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a great question. The answer is there's just too much supply. And there aren't enough tenants going forward to fill all the out-of-town retail warehousing, as we call it, space that's been developed. I absolutely agree. They make very good, you know, often edge of town, lots of parking, and particularly in a COVID environment where, you know, lots of space. That, you know, they do are clearly an opportunity for click and collect rests there. The question, of course, is just what are the retailers prepared to pay for this space? And what we are in the throes of is just a recalibration of pricing. You know, the rents are going to go down, the yields will expand, and you'll get effectively a new capital value. And that's what we saw with, you know, Hammerson were due to sell a large portfolio to Orion, and Orion pulled out of the transaction and gave up their £21 million deposit, which means they must be feeling, you know, very nervous about the future. And I would agree that's with, you know, with their decision in some respects. It was sillier than to get involved in the first place. But it's there is a home for a lot of this, or a purpose for a lot of this retail warehousing. It's just what price can the occupier pay?
Okay. Moving on again, student property has been a key area for people investing in what are kind of property alternatives, a good source of rental income there. But again, obviously, with the disruption to university life, the university academic year from the coronavirus, the share prices have fallen heavily. In your results, you seem they're quite optimistic there'll be a quick rebound when the universities reopen. But I just wonder, you know, really? I want to test your conviction on that, just because, you know, the numbers of overseas students coming back is going to be down sharply, and perhaps even UK students won't be so keen to go to university, given that the universities are going to be, you know, having to try out new ways of teaching online and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think there are three factors here. The first is the fundamental one is that the purpose-built student accommodation, so not a, you know, the polar opposite of the terraced house that you and I lived in university. So these are purpose-built, their Wi-Fi is superb, security, etc. It's students want to live in these places rather than renting off, you know, a dodgy landlord. And that's the first point. The second is that when we look at what each subsector's response will be in a post-COVID environment, if you were to look at hotels, the answer is even if hotels are allowed to open, the recovery is going to be gradual because there are, you know, how much, you know, the speed at which business comes back, the speed at which tourism comes back. It's at best a sloping recovery, like a sort of Nike swish is our view of recovery. In the case of student accommodation, it's a V-shaped recovery. If these universities are able to open and students wish to return, I'll come back to your other point, then we will see them fill up quickly again. Now, the two negative mitigating factors you've already raised. The first is, well, how many of us will want to go back if the very large lectures are online and only tutorials and smaller groups are face-to-face? And the fact of the matter is, if that is what is on offer for the entire tertiary education community across Europe, then that's what they will be. And if students say, well, I don't want to do that, I'm going to give up going to university and I'm going to throw my hat into the employment market, even though I'm less qualified and we're in a recession, we think that's not going to be the case. They will accept what you know, these restrictions and get on with it and go back to university. As far as foreign students are concerned, you're absolutely right. This is a concern. And when you look at the share price of Unite, it was at £13. It's now at £8.60. And we think that's reflecting concerns about when universities are going to open, but also that absolutely, there will be an awful lot of students who aren't able to come, you're able to get back to the UK. But we don't think that's going to be a permanent situation. And there is a huge, huge number of students across Asia and other parts of the world who want to come and study in Europe, in the UK, and actually in the US. And that this is a very important point. The US is not open to them. The Trump administration is not being helpful to increase the number of Asian students. Whereas we are, you know, have been opening, welcoming with open arms, which is absolutely great. You know, tertiary education is a major part of our export world, and that's, you know, we think that it will come back.
Okay, well, that, thanks for your response to my scepticism there. That's that is useful information. We've gone through a variety of sectors, and that's great. But now, more broadly, where are you looking for safe, resilient income? You know, our view is that the people are going to be watching or listening rather to this. A lot of them are income investors, and they've seen, you know, their equity income funds and trusts have suffered very badly. Dividends being cut right, left, and centre, as you know. TR Property, in your results today, you've actually, although the portfolio has been hit by the recent declines, you increased full year dividends by 3.7%. You pay 14p, or are paying 14p per share, and that's covered by earnings. So all that's quite sort of positive, but the outlook is tough, is it not?
Yeah, Gavin, absolutely, the outlook is tough. But what we have done is, and this has been going on for some time now, we've been positioning the portfolio into what we call income resilience. And four areas, some of which we've discussed, would be we've talked about logistics, industrial, student accommodation obviously is a concern in the short run. Healthcare is a major part of our universe now. And then you can buy that both in the UK through Assura, Target Healthcare, Primary Health Properties, and then in Europe through Cofinimmo, through ECAD, Idifica, etc. So these have been, you know, healthcare, particularly something like Assura and primary health properties, you've effectively got NHS-backed income. I mean, this is really, really solid. And we've seen very high collection rates. Supermarket Income REIT is paying you over 5%. We talked about that. But a really, really big part of our world and a big part of TR property is the private residential sector. So this isn't buy to let in a kind of mum and dad basis. This is institutional, huge numbers of flats, particularly in Germany, Sweden, and Finland. And what's so interesting about Germany and Sweden is that rents are regulated. So they are index linked, but are well below open market. As a consequence, you have virtually 100% occupancy. So we have exposure to companies like Vonovia, LEG, Deutsche Wohnen, Phoenix Spree, and then in Finland, Kojamo, Sweden for Balder. If you look at the share prices of these businesses, they're in some cases they're back to their pre-COVID highs, and this is just because this income is incredibly secure. And I think so for the board of TR Property, they look forward into what's happening next year. And of course, we'll receive no rent from our modest exposure to European shopping centres in the short run. Some of our office names have clearly cut their dividends temporarily, but we have this huge cohort of those who will still pay. So our income is likely to be down next year relative to the year just gone. But we do have over 1 year of full revenue reserves. So the board are very much taking the view they want to pay out what we've earned for the year to 2020, March 2020. And then, you know, we know what we're looking at going forward. And, you know, if we have to cover a shortfall for 1 year, I'm sure the board will be, you know, looking at that as something that they can do. But I think it's a very important and strong message that they have increased the dividend for the year to March 2020.
Yeah, okay. I was going to ask you about revenue reserves, so thanks very much for that. You've answered that. So that revenue reserves are something that investment trusts, closed-end funds can do, whereas open-ended funds can't because they've got to distribute all their income. Talking about the difference between investment trusts and open-ended funds, obviously a lot of the open-ended funds, all of the open-ended funds in the UK are suspended at the moment. Have you seen any or noticed any sort of forced selling of properties by open-ended fund managers?
It's interesting that whilst they are under the current level of suspension, the current rate suspended situation, no, we haven't. However, prior to that, a lot of them were suspended after the referendum decision in 2016. And we did see quite a lot of selling. The problem for these funds is they were therefore selling what they could sell, what we in the property industry call dealing off the top of the pack. So you saw them sell prime city offices, supermarkets, industrial estates, etc. What they didn't sell was their retail property. So there, a lot of them are effectively gone into this current cycle of being locked, unable to subscribe or redeem. But they've still got an awful lot of retail property that when they come out of it, that will get marked down again. For TR props, one of the things being closed-ended, and when you compare us with open-ended equity funds, is we have this wonderful situation where we're able to buy positions in small companies. And therefore, what we have seen is, particularly in the dark days of the last couple of weeks of March, the opportunity to increase exposure to some of our favorite small cap companies at very discounted prices.
What sort of companies are we talking about, Marcus?
We've bought there's a group of them, and I think it'd be I'm not sure I want at this stage to go in name names because some of the positions we've taken are reasonably material, I'm afraid it's probably sensitive.
Okay,
in all honesty, but ones that
I'll look out for the stock exchange announcements of the RNS on that. But what you're saying is though you're using the advantage, the resilience of the investment trust structure because you're not because you don't have money flowing in and out of the fund. Therefore, you're not forced to sell things when people are pulling money out. When people sell investment trust shares, the price gets hit, but you've still got the capital to play with. Is that right?
Absolutely. And we've held small companies. We have about 15, 20% of the portfolio in these small companies, which are all across Europe. And when you look back at the history of the trust, and I've been running it now I've been involved for over 20 years with TR Props and been running the fund for going up for 10. We've had great success with these smaller companies because they tend to either get bigger through merger or they are successful businesses, they raise capital in the market, or if they're standing at big discounts to asset value, they get taken private. Because one of the great joys of the real estate equity market is there's more commercial property is owned privately than publicly. And these companies will, if they trade at big discounts to asset value, private money will come in and take them out.
We saw a couple of deals last year, didn't we? Green Real Estate Investment Trust, AJ Mucklow, were both taken out. Are you expecting more deals like that, more mergers and acquisitions after the stock market crash?
Absolutely. I mean, in the case of Green, what we look for, Green was an absolute classic, where management owned nearly 15% of the company. They were not going to sit there and see their personal wealth trade significantly below asset value. Their shares traded around the 140 to 160 euro, one spot four, spot six, and they sold the business at 194, one spot 94 euros. So they absolutely knew what they were doing. And so we look to back management. We like companies that have strong family ownership. Argan, our French logistics business, is 50% owned by the Lalonde family. Great. You are backing smart people who've got their own money, their own skin in the game, and that's absolutely crucial. In the case of Mucklow,
okay.
Rupert Mucklow wanted to retire, and the merger with LMP was brilliant, and it's been proved so.
Okay, last question, Marcus. I mean, you say you've been involved in the sector and involved in the investment trust for two decades now. So you've seen a lot in that time. How are you feeling about the asset class, the real estate sector? You sound quite upbeat and quite engaged. What is your mood, given the challenges ahead?
The answer is you've got to pick your runners and riders very carefully. I'm afraid no point swimming against the tide. We've got some retail businesses that look incredibly cheap. They're having wonderful sort of bear rallies at the moment. And you guys will know which ones those are. We think they've got huge fundamental problems going forward. On the other hand, plenty of other sectors where we can make money. We haven't talked about some of our Scandinavian investments. We've got a brilliant little supermarket investor owner called Cibus in Finland, Sweden. We've got a very nice office developer in Madrid called Arima, which is trading well below book, got lots of cash, very established management, been around the track several times. So for us, it's quite exciting if you can get into the right areas. But fundamentally, what we do see is that this huge amount of state and central government capital largesse is going to lead to very, very low interest rates for a very long time. And investors are going to need income. And of course, way back in the sort of distant past, the ugly word inflation could also raise its head for different reasons. And therefore, we see real assets as something that you will, investors should have as part of a diversified portfolio.
Absolutely. Well, Marcus, that's all we've got time for, but thanks very much for talking to us about giving us such a great overview of, as you say, what is an important asset class for many income investors. Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Gavin. Goodbye.